Welcome to the ISF Podcast from the Information Security Forum. The ISF Podcast is hosted by ISF CEO Steve Durbin. And every episode he brings listeners features timely conversations, practical insights, and resources for global cybersecurity professionals. I'm producer Tavia Gilbert. In today's episode, Steve speaks with Clinton Mixon, Information Security Lead at the New School and Adjunct Assistant Professor at the Center for Global Affairs at New York University. Clinton has been a leader in cyber for over 30 years. He was one of the founders of the Air Force Cyber College, where members of the U.S. Air Force train in cybersecurity, and he's been responsible for running training exercises for the New York City government. Clinton and Steve talk about his work to make New York the most cyber-resilient city in the world, as well as tips on how to include and communicate with all departments and employees on what to do in case of a crash or a breach.
So, Clint, hi. Thanks very much for joining me on the podcast today. Great to have you.
Thanks. Thanks for having me, Steve, and I appreciate the opportunity.
You are the Information Security Lead at the New School, and in addition to teaching at NYU, your former position was at the City of New York. Now, you've also been in the military, in the U.S. Air Force, and part of U.S. Cyber Command and Cyber National Mission Force. I think I've got that right, yeah?
Yes, you do, Steve. And of course, just have to get this out of the way up front, right? The views and opinions that I express today in no way reflect those of the U.S. government or any of my employers. These are all mine and mine alone.
And I'm particularly interested in hearing those views on things like achieving resilience in the face of significant or targeted threat activity, you know, critical infrastructure. I'd love to talk to you a little bit about that. And also, I know people always like this, understanding how to successfully manage culturally diverse teams across multiple locations. So we'll see if we can touch on some of those in the course of the podcast. But first, in your class, Mission Assurance or Continuity of Operations at NYU, you teach students about primary, alternate, contingency, and emergency operations plans. Talk us through that. What does that exactly mean? You know, how does that apply to business? Give us some insight.
Yeah, thanks, Steve. It's actually a great question. And as you indicated, it connects directly to resiliency. And in fact, I often use this as my main talking point for resiliency. And as you indicated, right, definition of PACE as an acronym is primary, alternate, contingency, and emergency. And a simpler way of thinking about it is I need to get something done. What is that thing that needs to occur? In this case, what information or data needs to flow? And how do I currently do it? Right? That's my primary way. My alternate method is what other way could I get that information to where it needs to go or use it in the way it needs to be used? And contingency is that third way. And emergency is the absolute minimum. How do I have to get this? What is the minimum data elements for that? I'll give you a quick example because I do think, like you said, a lot of businesses don't necessarily think this through, but it applies to every business. And I haven't come up with a line of business, to be honest with you, where I can't come up with this. Now, I will say this. Businesses and organizations who do strictly data work, right, where it's just moving of information or and doing those kind of things are going to struggle because very quickly they're going to run out of ways to do that in the modern world and things like that. Mm-hmm. Something like a news broadcast, right? I've only so many different ways I can get the news out
right
into the modern day world at the speed that we need to. But in the case of taking payments, let's just say I'm a suit company and I make suits and I sell them. But individuals come in and they do their fitting and then I collect payment at the end. Well, as we all know, the primary method for doing that today is through either a debit card or a credit card machine where I just place my card and it reads it. But we all remember, at least I do, and I'm sure Steve, being of a similar generation, sir, that we remember that wasn't always the case, right? We do all remember the good old fashioned slide machines, right, for actually doing the transactions. Mechanical, but still effective because it collects all the data.
A trip down memory lane. I used to love those machines.
Yes. It was always interesting, right, to see if the imprint did come across exactly the way it should or the business wanted it to. So having those as part of that suit supplies, you know, emergency processes and procedures that the individuals who work there know how to do the slide machine, that's another one, mm-hmm. right? In a contingency world, we can go back to, and unfortunately, right, again, cash used to be king. There are still certain business elements that use cash. They could transition to a cash-only methodology. And then finally, right, depending on the history of that customer with the company, you might actually just extend them credit and say, please come by at your earliest convenience. Because again, they have the suit. They haven't given it to you quite yet. So you need to come and pay for that suit upon pickup versus pay upon initial fitting and things like that. So that's a very simple example that I think a lot of companies could use when they're trying to do small things like collect funds for services rendered or services given.
Yeah, and it's interesting you should say that, because it was actually just a couple of weekends ago that I was out shopping. We went into this store and they had written up signs saying, sorry, our machines are down, we can only take cash, which I thought was rather quaint, but nobody was buying anything. That was the thing. So they may as well have been shut, because there was just no point there. So clearly they hadn't worked through what the contingency plan might be come the day that, you know, the internet is down or the machines don't work or whatever that might be.
And that is a piece too, Steve, as you indicated, right? The customer in this case also has to be resilient in their forms of payment that they have available, right?
Yeah.
I often ask people when I give discussions on resiliency, how many of you have $100 in your pocket right now?
Right.
And I think, Steve, neither one of us would be surprised at how few people carry cash on their person anymore. And I did. When I was a teenager, my mother always, back then, right, $20 was kind of the coin of the realm. And so I kept an emergency 20 in my wallet, right, hidden away from myself. I didn't spend it on, you know, the Coca-Cola or the candy bar I wanted, but squirreled away. So if I needed $20, I knew I had $20. So the customer needs to bring you resiliency as well. It just cannot be put on the businesses only.
No, you're absolutely right. I have a 20-pound note that I've been carrying around for, without a word of a lie, the last 12 months. And I had to break into it the other day when I was going along and watching a game of rugby with my dad. And we were season ticket holders, but for this particular game, we also had to pay something to get through the gate. So it was fortunate I had that £20 note, because they were just taking cash on the gate there. But 12 months. There you go. So let's dig into that in a little bit more detail. So you know, people listening to this, businesses are thinking to themselves, okay, I get all of that, but I'm working on a limited budget. What are some of the must-dos in terms of emergency response planning and risk management, perhaps, that they could take to minimize the effects of an incident?
Yeah, so on that, right, I'm not going to come out with a lot of brilliant, brand new, shocking things. I think most businesses and corporations understand disaster preparedness, business continuity planning, and things like that. But the biggest piece is making sure that you truly understand what is critical to business versus what is nice to have in business.
Right.
And so just like, again, right, going back to that store, doing the credit card transactions, how critical is it that you get paid at the time of fitting versus paid at the time of delivery? So truly understanding your data elements, the data flows that allow your business to operate on a daily basis or meet whatever continuity situation that your particular line of business requires. So knowing that, mapping that out to its completeness, where does the data originate? Where is it created? How is it passed? How is it stored? Where is it then archived? And then eventually, right, going through the entire information lifecycle, how does it get destroyed at the time when it's no longer useful? Understanding that down to the machine, down to the wire, down to the hard drive is a critical element of making sure that you're going to be able to be resilient when that eventual breach or that ransomware event happens, because that's where you want to spend most of your defensive budget. That's where you want to spend most of your time, truly thinking through how are we going to ensure that those elements, not the nice to haves, not the easy to haves, but how are we going to ensure that those data elements or those data flows are always protected? Now, we all know that it's no longer a world of if breach, right? We know we all will be breached at some point and that there will be an incident or event,
right?
So due to that, you need to go through that pace planning again. You again need to go through that, and it needs to be practiced, right? So the particular company that I was talking about, that was actually a real world case, and I was talking with the salesperson about this. He knew they had the slide machines. He knew they actually had the credit card slide machines. I said, but can you go down into the storage room and put your hands on them right now? And he just kind of smiled and chuckled and laughed at me, right? Because they don't exercise that. And so I would say that's the other big thing, right? We all know, right? I'll go back to your sports analogy, right? I'm a great football watcher,
yeah.
Right? I'm really good at critiquing all of the both American football and European football. I'm very good at critiquing that. But doing that and knowing about how the game is played and knowing the strategies and tactics is much different from actually getting on the field and doing it. And I think that's probably one of the biggest things I would say as well is if you have a business continuity plan, if you have a disaster response plan, but you haven't actually exercised it, if your people don't know what to do, then they're not going to be able to do it under this high stress, really time intensive event that you're facing and that kind of thing. I would also say that there's a couple of people that often get left out of these, and those are the lawyers and actually your communications and marketing people. They're doing lots of things for your organization, but day to day, they never think about what would we say, how would we handle an incident involving cyber. And that can really make or break an organization because of all of the regulatory and also legal things that are coming out. And also, again, we can't go around in our world of very, you know, litigious as it is and not talk about the fact that you might say something or someone may give some kind of indication and that might end up in a suit, right? That you were not doing your due diligence in protecting the information or the data. And that could come from internally, from the board. It also could come from externally, from your stockholders or from your customers. So including those lawyers and those marketing people in those real world practice exercises, I believe, is essential to making sure that you can respond and respond appropriately.
Yeah, some really good insights there, Clint. And certainly I would just underline that, because over the last 12 months, we have run so many cyber simulation exercises all around the world where the best ones have, and sometimes we've had to push, but the best ones have had all of those different people actually joining in. And as I say, sometimes we've had to push that because they've been, oh, you don't actually need the legal guy today, or he's busy, he can't make it. And when you have a breach, that's not a good enough answer, is it? I'm busy, I can't make it. So
no, it's not okay. Because again, if they're not there for practice, they won't understand all of the moving parts and won't be able to adequately provide their element. Right? All of these individuals are very important. Hopefully you're not paying people just to hang around in your company, your organization. So they need to be there. Even in cases where they're not there, right? Always think about, and this is something that comes from my military background, right? Always think about, can the person behind that person or underneath that person as their deputy, can they step into the breach at that time and actually take on those activities and do those? So why not? This is a great example and a great time. We have a tabletop exercise going on. George can't make it. He's out because of family medical reasons. Hey, let's bring in Sue. She's the deputy. And she comes in and gets that experience and provides that knowledge to him when he comes back. So always exercising even down another level in leadership is not a bad thing at all and can definitely improve your chances of success.
Good points there. So let's now look specifically at critical infrastructure. So you've led training programs in various aspects of cybersecurity for both small and indeed large teams, including for over 50,000 New York City staff members. What are some of the distinct challenges that face such large teams? Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, Steve, I'd actually like to start, Steve, answering this question by talking about the shared challenges, challenges that are present doing kind of training or education in any size of organization. There are things that are specific to large versus small teams, but they all face a very common set of barriers. One is the language barrier when it comes to cyber. The number one skill that I think I bring to anybody who employs me is I'm a pretty good translator between the business owners and the tech people. And so those two organizations, even though they're in the same company, maybe they're in the same government organization, they don't speak the same language. And I often see that as a big problem. So everybody's going to have a language barrier problem they have to overcome to explain cyber. That goes all the way from the C-suite level, by the way, or the, you know, in the government level, from the chief or the head of the ministry, all the way down to the everyday worker. They all need to understand this, and you have to use language that's appropriate to them. You have to meet them where they are when it comes to their understanding of this environment and what's going on. The other thing is that it's a very diverse audience. You're going to have individuals who may be highly technical and have tons of certifications, but no real formal education, where at the same time, you might have a person who has a PhD that's leading your research team. It's a vast difference in audiences that you, again, have to make the messages tailored to them so they can consume it and truly understand it. The other thing is it's all about changing culture when it comes to cybersecurity. We are not going to tech our way out of it, is my kind of saying. Tech got us into this, but tech's not going to get us out of it. It comes down to the culture and the people. And the other large thing is, and this is, again, scheduling and organizing the actual incident response practices is extremely difficult. To your point, Steve, you brought up, right? Someone wasn't there,
right?
That's always going to be true. So scheduling these things for max participation. Now, large teams, they do have certain issues that definitely plague their ability to do this. And one of those is you have to convince a lot of leaders, right? In this case, you may have multiple, you know, staffs where you have a senior leader that runs this. To your point, in New York City government, right? Over 100 city agencies. And we have to convince the actual person in charge of that agency who responds directly to the mayor about this topic. And we have to win them over to make them understand cybersecurity. So it's a scale issue, and it takes a lot of time. With that time, it also costs. So the resource cost is not just time, but it's also money. Many of these services that do education at the user level, it's per person is how they actually charge you. So the larger the organization, the more money it's going to cost you. The other piece is there's just more chances for bad choices. We all know that it comes down to, right, the human is still the weakest link in this chain of preventing an incident or a breach from occurring, and just more people means more chances. And then again, you most likely are going to be leading a larger team because you have a larger organization. So keeping your own team aligned on speaking points of where you're going, that's really challenging if you have a large team that's trying to do this. Now, a small team has issues as well. Most likely, your team members are filling multiple roles. So now they're having to time share between all the different things that you have them doing. In addition, the organization itself is going to be balancing cybersecurity with the needs of the business. And then this is the issue, right? Cybersecurity doesn't make you any money on a day-to-day basis. It costs you money. Mm-hmm. But what it does is it ensures your actual revenue stream in the future. And it's all about buying future time, buying future revenue. But it's not going to give you anything right now today. And again, one person in a small organization, typically those individuals have an outsized ability to impact your culture change because everybody knows anybody, everybody in a small organization. You all know each other by name. You probably know each other's families. You may have met their significant other or their children. And because one person may not get on board with cyber, it actually might be much harder to move a small organization than it is to move a large organization, where you can kind of get, you know, we typically talk about bandwagoning being a bad thing. Mm-hmm. But in the case of cybersecurity, if I get 7 of the 8 board members on board, the 8th person might just fall in line because they go, well, everybody else is doing it. And that's not a bad thing when it comes to cyber. Everybody doing cybersecurity training because 7 out of 8 people are doing it, and I'll just do it because they are, is not a bad thing at all.
Right. And one of the things that this, you know, I'm sitting here listening to this and I'm thinking that's probably okay if people at least understand the role that cyber plays. But, you know, you were part of a team developing a strategy that focused on making New York City the most cyber resilient city in the world. And, you know, listeners may recall that not so long ago, there was dreadful flooding in New York, and the mayor, I think, had eventually called in a shelter in place order. And I think people can understand those kinds of things if you're working in the city because it's physical. But I'm just interested to hear, how did you go about getting the importance of cyber, and so therefore cyber resilience, across to people who I'm guessing here are probably more comfortable dealing with what happens if there's an incident on the subway or flooding, and you know, like we had not so long ago? Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, so I think one of the biggest things, Steve, and I just like to emphasize this, we as the Cyber Command team spent a long time thinking about what our mission, vision, piece would be. And as you indicated, right, it wasn't about some cybersecurity thing. It was about resiliency. It was about making sure that the New York City government could continue to govern in the way that its citizens need it to actually govern and provide those services that only the government can provide. So that was one of the biggest things. And so not couching it in terms of, hey, preventing a breach or protecting your data and doing those things, but really putting it into that same realm, as you indicated, right? For emergency management is going to talk about the resiliency of this city to handle these natural disasters. And so that's one of the biggest things, was making sure that we were latching on to a language and to a mindset that already existed in the city. That can't be overstated. The other piece is it comes down to stakeholder engagement, right? You have to have buy-in. And as you indicated, right, these particular agency leads, they all know their business. They know their agency in and out. Many of them may have been in that agency for 20 or 30 years, in some cases, growing up through the leadership chain in that organization. So getting them to understand why cyber is important to them and speaking in their language of their particular agency, that was critical. We spent a lot of time doing that. We had individuals specifically employed to just do that, stakeholder management at the agency level. The other piece is that people need to understand that it's about risk management, that you're not going to be able to protect them all the time and keep everything safe. It's just like the flooding that you mentioned, Steve, right? On a day-to-day right. basis, flooding's not that big of an issue in the city, but it's going to happen. So we can only do so much. Mother Nature still reigns supreme when it comes to those things. And cyber is not Mother Nature always, can be, which is a whole other topic. But it's just the fact that there are so many actors out there trying to go after municipalities and businesses for a myriad of reasons. And so that is the thing that they need to understand. And that then drives them to go, do you know your important data? Do you know your important data flows? Have you made those resilient? The other big thing is in any large bureaucracy is identifying a champion above your organization. Who is that person that's truly next to the senior, most senior decision maker that can whisper in that person's ear when you need them to? They can also gauge what the senior, most senior leader, in this case with the city, right, the mayor is thinking about cybersecurity and pass that information to you. Mm-hmm. Because what you want to do is you want to latch on to things that are similar and creating similar outcomes as a person might experience based on cyber. So we talked about flooding, right? It's also possible and sadly, you know, very scary for a lot of people who understand this stuff that operational technology is not as secure as it needs to be. And so, right, New York City, massive city, gets all of its water, right, from myriad of upstate reservoirs and lakes and things like that. Well, that is only happening because the operational technology is there to enable those pumps and valves and cleaning systems and settling ponds all to do their job. So it's very possible, unfortunately, right? It's possible that after a lot of work, some malicious actor might be able to create a flooding type incident in the city. And so making sure that people understand that the things that cyber creates a lot of times will mimic the outcomes created by Mother Nature or other things that are larger than we can control. The other big piece is don't forget about your team. Your team's running, they're out there charging, they're doing all this stakeholder engagement, they're constantly talking about it. They still need to be led. You still need to know, let them know that they matter and that they are actually one of your priorities. I see a lot of leaders, unfortunately, that become so mission focused that they forget that their team also requires them to be there for them as a leader on the day-to-day situations.
Now, you also spent a number of years in the U.S. Air Force, where latterly your work involved nation-state security. And of course, we talk a lot about nation-state attacks, malicious actors that are perhaps nation-state sponsored and so on. And as part of U.S. Cyber Command at Fort Meade, you developed a range of response options in relation to adversarial malicious activity. What can you tell people listening to this who are perhaps responsible for at least dealing with that potential threat in their organizations? What can you share with them when it comes to facing off against such attacks?
Yeah, I think I'd like to talk about, you kind of led with, you know, the change in the environment, and it has changed and cyber continues to change every day.
Right.
To me, the largest change has actually been in the scale and the scope of the noise.
Right.
There are so many actors out there now, both good and bad. The area of just monitoring and just seeing all the activity is just absolutely catastrophically high. It's very big. And it's hard for one person or even one organization to take all that in at a given time. So again, that means that you have to prioritize what you're looking at. You have to prioritize what things matter to you. You have to prioritize those actors that you think are most likely. And so a cyber threat intelligence program that's focused on what matters to you and not just focused on cyber threats in general is very critical to you having success in protecting your mission or your particular business operation. The other one that I think is very critical is that the dumb, I will say it this way, might not necessarily be so politically correct, but the dumb and the poorly funded hackers, they're all gone, right? The cops around the world, the different organizations doing law enforcement, we've swept all those people up. If you're a noisy, not good, you know, hacker who's making a lot of noise when you do stuff, we got you. We found you a long time ago. We've gotten you off the keyboard. You're in some kind of program where you're not going to get to a computer anymore. So what we're dealing with now are individuals and organizations that are willing to put in a long amount of time and a large amount of effort over that long period of time to get the results that they want to get to, right? We're not seeing the smash and grab kind of things that we used to see in the past,
right?
But we are seeing things that take years, right? All we have to look is at the solar wind situation, right? That was years in the making,
right?
That took somebody sitting down and planning out every single step in that entire compromise. Because it wasn't a given that any one of those steps was actually going to succeed. So they had to move, and then they had to sit and wait. And they're willing to do that. And that is one of our biggest challenges. You know, the United States is known, and Americans are known generally around the world, as being fast-paced and very short-sighted. And I mean that time-wise, very short-sighted. Whereas the actors that we see out there now, they are taking advantage of that. And they're planning five-year-long missions, or they're planning 10-year-long campaigns, but they're just going to chip away at things slowly and easily. and Americans responsible for security in an organization and a government are going to rotate into that seat, rotate out of that seat. Talent's going to be lost. Talent's going to be gained. And the malicious actor is sitting there very quietly, very easily, because of the quiet nature of their activities, slowly ticking off the steps in their campaign plan and things like that. The other big piece, when we talk about critical infrastructure and that particular topic in your question here, we also have a problem where I can't just schedule downtime for operational technology. And I think this is one of the largest misconceptions. People think it's a computer. I can just run a patch and I'll be good to go. Well, Con Ed can't just shut down their electricity generation facility to update all of the different operational technology components when they find out there's a vulnerability present, right? When a large operational technology vendor, such as Schneider or Johnson Controls, when they have an issue, it's global in scale. And that's the issue, is that with that global scale, limited ability to actually patch or fix, it's a really big issue that has to be thought through and people have to work together on. Because like I said, I can't just shut down the electricity generation for half of New York City overnight so I can get my technology up to speed about the most recent vulnerability or even potentially the latest threat brief that I got that says now they are targeting that particular, you know, programmable logical controller or RTU or whatever it may be that's critical to the operational technology performing its mission.
And I think it's that, you know, you've touched on a few things there, Clint, that, I mean, when I talk to boards, they're still surprised at just the sheer scale. You know, you make the point there about you can't just shut down operational technology. But also the thing that people, I think, are very surprised at is the degree of patience that a malicious actor has today. And I think you made that point very well, because it's still, I think, to some people quite shocking that they do have these long-term strategies that they're prepared to roll out and review on a tactical basis. And that, for me anyway, is one of the biggest learnings that we have to try to get people to really understand and come to terms with, whether they be in critical infrastructure, whether they be in small business, right the way around the whole commercial sphere. Because we've moved so far beyond, and you made this point really well, we've moved so far beyond the hacker being the guy in the hoodie hunched in the kitchen table. You know, these are now professional businesses that understand what they want, know where to get it, and prepared to sit it out and bide their time. And I think that changes the game. And we have to be equally, I think, resilient and indeed responsive to that as we go forward in all of the businesses that we run today.
And Steve, I would like to highlight on the comment that you made there, right?
Yeah, sure, go ahead.
Is the professionalism of the hacker,
right?
And how they are now a business and they run themselves like a business. That, you know, it's no longer the one or two people having a Friday night hack session, you know, with pizza and, yeah, and Jolt Cola and all of those kind of things, right? These individuals are professionals. I mean, we hear about ransomware companies, right, issuing individuals on the dark web contracts that have money back guarantees, right? This will work. We guarantee it. And if it doesn't work, if it doesn't capture the number of individuals or organizations that you want, we will refund your money. That is a professional organization who's willing to do marketing, right, to actually stand by a product. And unfortunately, right, we live in a world where sometimes the physical products we buy come with no warranties whatsoever. So they've definitely professionalized. I also think the other big thing with it is that there are so many organizations and people with so many very specific causes that motivate them to action. Mm-hmm. And that they are all now realizing that there is a cyber element to getting their point across or making their cause stand out in the very noisy news environment that we have, right? So if I want to get my thing at the top of the CNN ticker, all I have to do is potentially create this cyber event. And because cyber is such the big word today, I'm going to get that 30-minute headline on CNN, which I would never be able to get before because I didn't have a way of going after the organization to make that kind of headline stand out. Protesting at the gates doesn't get the headline. The organization having to shut down or admit to regulators that they have been breached, that gets the headline. And it's pretty easy to see that connection from all kinds of different viewpoints on how absolutely easy it is to get that headline when you use a cyber action.
Yeah, and for me anyway, that's what makes this industry so very fascinating and a great place to work, because no day is the same. It's really fast moving. It's constantly changing and challenging. And, you know, Clint, you've really shone a light on some of the areas that certainly you've been involved with. And I think our listeners will have gone away, hopefully, with a slightly different perspective on some of these things. And if nothing else, on just the sheer scale of the challenge that is facing the good guys out there. So thank you very much indeed for taking the time to share that in such an interesting and lively manner. It's been great talking to you.
Steve, thank you very much for having me. I've enjoyed the conversation, and I'm here to work with all of the defenders out there should they ever need any help from a person like myself. And if I can help you, Steve, or the organization anyway, please do not hesitate to reach out.
We'll be sure to do that. Thanks very much indeed, Clint.
Thanks to today's guest, Clinton Mixon. ISF members, be sure to log in to ISF Live to access all of our comprehensive research, reports, and tools related to these conversations. And to our listeners who want to become an ISF member, get in touch with your regional representative at securityforum.org/join. We'll be back soon with another valuable conversation. And in the meantime, be sure to check out the ISF Analyst Insight podcast, which goes in-depth on the hottest topics in information security. The ISF podcast is produced by TalkBox and Tavia Gilbert, with senior producer Katie Flood. Mix and master by Kayla Elrod. Music by Alexander Filipiak. Thanks for listening.